CatholicRadio.net and click on the app banner.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Before I introduce my very interesting guest for this hour, I want to remind our listeners that you can always email me at dhudson@avemariaradio.net. That's dhudson@avemariaradio.net. Or if you want to hear past shows, just Google Church and Culture and Archive and Ave Maria Radio, and you'll find a little link to the archive of all the last, now 2 years, of Church and Culture radio shows. I said I had a very special guest, and I do. Her name is Sally Miller. And Sally Miller is on Church and Culture today to tell a very remarkable story of her life, a life filled with fabulous high points, such as being named Miss Arkansas in 1958 and going to Atlantic City with Burt Parks back in the good old days of the Miss America pageant, and finishing in the top 10 and finishing first in her talent, singing an aria from Verdi, from Rigoletto. She went on in her life to accomplish many things, including being the first person ever to run the 4,000 length of the Great Wall of China, which took her 7 months. But in between those two high points, she made the choice, I'm sure she'll call it a bad choice, to have a brief affair with then-Governor Bill Clinton of Arkansas. That was in 1983. After that, it was quiet for a while, but then, of course, when Bill Clinton ran for president in 1992, things started to come out, including his brief fling, I should say, or romance with Sally Miller. Sally, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thank you, Gil. I'm happy to be here.
I just want to ask you off the bat, would you call yourself a victim of Bill Clinton?
No. I don't feel like a victim. I think when you allow someone to make you a victim, then they have all the power. And I don't feel powerless.
This happened 37 years ago, but yet it's something you still deal with every day of your life, correct?
I do. Their tactics were so dirty when they came after me that I guess I never put anything past them again. I never was a politician. I did run for mayor of my hometown of Pine Bluff, Arkansas.
As a Republican.
As a Republican.
That's right.
But the Democrats had already named their candidate. And you would have to go back in the past and realize that Arkansas was at that time a solid Democrat. It was the days of Senator John McClellan and William Fulbright. And Arkansas produced some very strong and powerful politicians, but they were never Republicans at that time. I'm sure you remember the story of Wilbur Mills and his little...
Oh, yeah. And the reflection pool in front of the Capitol. Yeah, right.
Yeah, with Fannie Fox.
Right.
And
speaking of that story, I really only have one other what I consider a tough question to ask you before we start telling the story of what I would consider a great spiritual struggle throughout your life, because we're going to go back to some of the issues in your childhood and your first and your marriage that led to that 3 months fling with Governor Clinton, and subsequently, of course, opened you to the wrath of very powerful people and also the wrath of the media. What do you think when you're included in the so-called bimbo eruptions, when you're called a bimbo? How does that make you feel?
It's very insulting. And I think it's probably the most demeaning thing you can do to another person is to lump them together with a slanderous statement. And I never wanted to be, sorority life was not that important to me. Any included group of women never was something that I sought. So the last thing I wanted to be was around women that were posing in Playboy for money.
But by the way, you got offered that at least once after you ran the Wall of China.
Yes.
And you got offered it by another magazine, but you turned it down both times, right?
Yes. First of all, I was Playboy called me from Chicago when I was training in Houston, Texas, and made a monetary request. They would like to send a photographer with me when I started the Great Wall, and at certain pretty parts.
Now, you were 50 years old then, right?
I was 49 when I started the Wall.
Well, I mean, when Playboy calls you at 49, that's, you know.
Well, yes, because I'd been running since I was 28, and then when the Chinese called and said we can make your long-standing dream come true, I accelerated my running from 6 miles a day to 12 miles a day. So I imagine I was in better shape than most women at 49.
I would imagine. And you turned Playboy down. Was there any reaction from their side?
No, they upped the price. I guess they thought the one.
If I recall, you weren't doing very well with money at that period of your life.
I never have been. I between my mother and, of course, the Clinton scandal, it was difficult to find jobs. At one point, I was on food stamps. And
well, I think Sally Miller, the best place to start, for our audience's sake, is during the 1992 campaign that Bill Clinton ran for his first term, you were approached by a Democratic operative. We don't have to say his name, but we know it. And you were offered a job, and then when you turned it down, you were threatened. Could you tell that story to our listeners?
After I finished the Wall, I went back to Arkansas, and not because I wanted to, it was something that I pretty much was forced to do. And after that, the college contacted me, and I was staying with my daughter in Atlanta, and they wanted to know if I could come to graduation and accept this accomplishment award.
Yeah, you had gone to what, that college in Pine Bluff? Is that right?
No, it was a college in St. Charles, Missouri, 8 miles outside of St. Louis. And from high school.
And the name of it was?
Lindenwood College for Women. It was a girls' school, college. And I had been invited there on full music scholarship when I graduated from high school in my hometown of Pine Bluff. So I was happy. I was making good grades. I won the Young Artist Contest, and my goal was that someday I would have a career in music, serious music. I had sung solos in my church.
Was that a Presbyterian church? I forgot.
I grew up in a Christian church, and then when I married at the age of 20, I transferred to my husband's family's church, which was Presbyterian.
Right.
And I just continued to sing there. But after I went off to college in St. Charles, I that summer between my sophomore and junior year was the year that I won Miss Arkansas. If you know anything about the Miss America pageant and beauty pageants, they keep you busy. So it's almost impossible to combine college or studies of any kind with making all these outside appearances. So I chose not to go back to school at Lindenwood. But all these years later, after I traveled the Great Wall, had been successful, they found me, and by this time they're a university. They're no longer, they're now a co-ed school. So they wanted to know if I could come to graduation that year, and it was 1991. All these dates. But anyway, I went back to college, and while I was there, they said, we'd like to offer you a job and the chance to have one of our new communications degrees. You can live on campus. We have a very nice apartment. And it just sounded wonderful. I said, can I bring my kitty cat? Oh, yes, bring your kitty cat. So here I am, my new home. I'm getting another degree, and I'm also working in their admissions office. And I've been there. This was the fall of I went back the spring of 1991, and then I went back to pack my clothes, and then I came back for the fall semester. In 1992, in January, I received a phone call, and it was from a reporter at the Arkansas State newspaper. And he said, we're running a story tomorrow and want to know if you'd like to comment. And I was thinking, oh, it's something about the Great Wall. And I said, and what is this story about? And he said, well, it's about how you were, you had a three-month affair with Bill Clinton. It's been confirmed by the state troopers. And we mentioned, of course, that you've left the state. Do you have a comment? And I said, I have no comment. Hung up.
Well, I guess your blood froze over at that moment.
Oh, at that moment, I wasn't sure that my feet would carry me to a chair.
Right. Because you were hoping after 8 years or 9 years that this would just quietly go away.
I made a big mistake in 1983, and it was because I was working on a Whale Historical Society for Arkansas. I had moved a steam locomotive. I've come from a railroading family, and I had moved this abandoned steam engine, from the park back to its birthplace, which was the Pine Bluffs Railroad Center, for restoration. And I knew there were a lot of abandoned cabooses and depots and things around the state, and I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could have a huge museum in the center of Little Rock, the capital of Arkansas, and then people could ride the engine, the steam locomotive, to my hometown of Pine Bluff, 50 miles away. It would bring revenue to the town, bring revenue to the state. So,
and your father worked on that rate, who you were very close to and who you admired greatly.
My father had engineered the 819 steam engine many years.
The last steam engine built out of St. Louis.
And you know, when I made plans to get it out of the park, the Cotton Duck Railroad was a subsidiary of the Southern Pacific Railroad, and I contacted the executives about their help in pulling this out. It became a very huge project, but one that was, it was all coming from the Southern Pacific Railroad. They were excited to do it. It's a great story. And they said, now, it can't come out on its own steam because so many parts have been removed. And it can't be fired up again. It's going to have to be restored before that will happen. So we're going to have our diesel engines pull it out, and they laid track from where it was in the park out to the main line. And they said, do you want to ride in the cab when it comes out? And I said, you know, more than that. I want to be there, but I want my father. I get real emotional over this, excuse me. I want my father to ride in it. And his best friend, another engineer, both retired, both the same age. So I have photos that are just beyond mention. My father is hanging out the window, and his friend, Icy Crosby, and me, the three of us. So we get to ride the steam.
But eventually, you contacted the governor's office for help with this project.
Yeah, I took my plan. I took my plan to him, went to his office. Now, I had met Bill in 1973 when he was a single guy, and he was interested in being a politician. He was working in the Capitol and helping with the 87th General Assembly. I had been invited by my attorney to be a Senate aide at the state level for this legislative session. And I would often see Bill in the hall. I would see him at the parties and different events that we had. So we were each very familiar. We had danced together, you know, we've stood at the hors d'oeuvre table and nibbled together. It was kind of a, it's interesting when you think back where everyone starts. And I never imagined he would be governor, let alone president. Never underestimate.
But you liked him very much when you knew him.
Liked him very much.
Yeah.
He was a very likable person. He had an afro haircut. And he,
well, they all did in those days, right?
No.
Except for me.
Hair,
I never succumbed myself. So fast forward to 1983, and you've got this wonderful restoration project of the 819 steam engine train.
Yeah,
and you call the governor's office and ask for an appointment.
I actually just walked in because I knew his secretary, Ms. Moore. I had known her from educational television when I worked there. I knew Ms. Moore and her husband, but that's another story. I went in his office. He was not there at the time, and she said, give me your number. And, of course, in those days, we didn't have cell phones. I gave her my home number. She said, I'll make sure Bill calls you back as soon as I see him. So I went home, back to, you know, where I lived. And shortly thereafter, I received a call from Bill. He was playing golf, and he was going to have dinner at the country club. And he said, can I drop by your place on the way home? And that made sense. I told him where I was living. And he said that
because you had a previous relationship with him, so this didn't seem to you inappropriate at the time.
No. This is someone I'd worked with, you know, way back.
Right.
About 10 years earlier. So he came by, and things just happened.
It all started there. Now, again, I asked you the question that I think our listeners need to hear, because this involves the beginning of your travails years later. You had this operative approach you. Now, start right there and tell that story.
Okay. I had been fired by the college because they said the Democrats had given them $1 million. I was called into the office.
Did they tell you that? What did they tell you when you were fired?
The president of the college calls me to his office. He was sitting there with his son-in-law. He had all of his family members on salary. This is a man named Dennis Spellman, who had also been written up in the Wall Street Journal as having unlawful practices, work ethics, violations. But the board of Lindenwood, for some reason, kept him on because he seemed to attract students.
Money.
Yeah, money.
That's what presidents do. They raise money.
Yeah, and you have to realize that when it was Lindenwood College for Women, it wasn't making money when colleges went co-ed.
None of the girls. Yeah, my sister was in a famous girls' school called Gulfport College down in Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
and it was having trouble keeping the doors open, but a certain hurricane settled that when it blew the college entirely away.
That's the only way they save money, right? Otherwise,
right.
It would have been going in the hole.
So did he actually say that it was your connection to Bill Clinton that made him let you go?
There were reporters running all over the campus. Where can we find Sally Miller Purdue?
So they had been alerted that you were going to be fired?
No. I'm just saying that's how the Democrats contacted Dennis Spellman, because everything on the campus had come alive because here was this woman being invited to be interviewed. There were reporters everywhere trying to find him. And they even came into the admissions office where I was working. So it was kind of known, worded spread, you know, that I was this person. So I have a feeling that when the Democratic Party realized that the college was well aware I was there and that I was attracting attention, they contacted the president of the college and said, we'll give you $1 million if you fire her.
Of course, now, I think we should distinguish between all Democrats and those who participated in the hit on you, who were probably in the Clintons, you know, tightly in the Clinton circle. I think that's fair, don't you?
Clinton's advantage. It was to the Clinton's advantage that,
right.
That I didn't talk to anyone.
Right.
More than anything, I think they were afraid of me because I had a background in broadcasting.
Yes, I mean, from age 16, you had been on TV and radio, and plus you had been a big hit at the Miss America pageant because the next day you were invited to be on the Today Show with Dave Garraway, which happened to be the first day Barbara Walters was on the show.
Yes.
And then you sang on the Ed Sullivan Show, which, you know, when I was growing up, that was the pinnacle of television success.
That was the ultimate. You know,
was he a nice guy, by the way, Ed Sullivan?
Actually, he was on vacation, and Dick Powell was taking...
Woo! Now, there's a Hollywood star. I mean, that's what he's one of the great stars of all time.
And his wife, June Allison, was also...
Oh, no! What were they like?
They were cuddly and holding hands, and they... If they weren't in love, they sure pretended well.
Sounds like they were.
They acted like they were happy to be together, but they acted very... They've acted very common, like one of us.
That's nice. I know Dave Garraway was a nice guy. I used to watch him on my old black and white TV when I was in grammar school.
He was the kind of guy that you just felt comfortable with, secure with.
Right.
And, of course, he had the glasses, and he just had the persona of a gentleman.
Yes.
And yet,
those were the good old days on TV, Sally.
Yes, believe me. And they didn't have teleprompters, and everything was live. And when we made mistakes, everyone saw them or heard them.
Now, did you sing Verity on the Today Show?
No. Didn't sing on the Today Show. Sang on the Ed Sullivan Show. And they actually had me sing The More I See You. They told me what to sing. And it was because the orchestra wanted to play that, and they wanted me to sing with them. So,
well, you know, we tried very hard to get a recording of your Verdi performance, your winning Verdi performance at the Miss America pageant, but we couldn't figure out how to transfer the digital file that you received from somebody who took it off of 78 records. And hopefully at some point we'll be able to broadcast that. And so when did this offer of a job and this threat happen?
Okay, so the president, his son-in-law, fired me, and they just said, now, if you can get the Republicans to bring us $1.5 million, we'll reinstate you.
No, they didn't.
Yes, they did. So here I am. And of course, my mind is running, okay, where am I going to live? I have a cat. Because they said, you can't stay on campus anymore. And I said, but you told me... I have an apartment, I have a stipend, and, of course, I have my kitty cat with me. And they said, that's out of the consideration now. You're gone. You can still attend classes and receive the degree, but you'll have to live off campus. You'll have to get money from some other source. This is the deal that we've made with the people who brought the money to us. I can only tell you it's the most devastating day of my life because here I was. I had a Jeep. I guess I could spend the night in the Jeep, but what about tomorrow and the next day, and where was I going to get money? And the very next day is when I had a phone call from a guy in Illinois, and he said, he really was a good old boy. He said, honey, I just heard the most terrible thing, that the college fired you. You don't have any money. You have a place to go. I need to talk to you. I think I can help you. And from there on, I met this man in a restaurant, in a very nice restaurant in a hotel. And he was going to talk to me about how I could have money and how my life would be better. And that's when he approached me with his federal job. at a level that I would receive $60,000 a year.
And that was a lot of money in those days.
Oh, my goodness. Put another zero behind it. Yeah, that was,
yeah.
To me, that was big money. And he said, but you won't have to work, baby. You won't have to work. You know, we know how to get around that kind of stuff. But you'll just be well paid and you'll be secure. You'll have some money coming in. But if you don't take this offer, I'll tell you what, it's going to get tough for you. And then he told me that they knew where I went running and that something just might happen to my pretty little legs. And, you know,
now, he actually looked you in the face and said all this?
Oh, goodness, and had that kind of southern good old boy sound, and it was so demeaning. It was, have you ever been talked down to?
Oh, yeah.
Ever just, okay. If he'd taken a hammer and beat me down on the ground, I couldn't have felt any worse. But what he didn't ever anticipate, you know, it takes me a long time because I keep thinking that everybody's good and nice and I grew up being a pleaser. But the young man who had been nice enough to loan me his couch that week, who worked in dining room services and was also getting another degree, and he was the only one that said, you know, you can come stay in my apartment and I won't bother you. You can have my couch and bring your cat. I asked him to come with me. And
so you had a third party witness to this.
Yeah. And he sat close by.
Which the FBI subsequently verified.
Yeah. And they even had the young guy come in and sign papers and to listen to the tape that he had so that they could verify that I was who I said I was, the gentleman was who he said he was, and what had happened really.
Are you saying you had a tape of this meeting?
That's what this young boy had was
a tape. Oh, my Lord.
And it taped this man making this proposal to me and then the threat if I didn't take it. And I just told him. I said, he said, I'll wait. You can think about it, and I'll call you tomorrow. I said, you have my answer right now. No. So that's where it is.
Your life could have been completely different if you had said yes. Could you have lived with yourself? Could you have lived with yourself?
No, I couldn't have lived with myself. But there again, I've always believed when it's a shady deal, you're not going to win. They'll make sure. It sounds good. Maybe I would have had a paycheck for 1 month. But I've seen too many times when ugly, nasty people have made promises. They have no intention of keeping them. It's just a stall tactic till they can, you know, eventually punish you more or walk away.
Sally, we're going to take a short break. This is fascinating and sad, but I appreciate your courage in being on the show today. I've been talking to Sally Miller. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
This week, Ave Maria Radio is pleased to highlight the K-8 Catholic education of St. Thomas the Apostle in Ann Arbor.
My name is Allie, and I attend fourth grade at St. Thomas. I love our school so much because everyone is so kind and loving. There are many different clubs in our school that you can join. I am part of the National Elementary Honor Society and Drama Club. My favorite subject is math because our new series is challenging but fun and educational. We go to church on Wednesdays, and I sing in the choir. It's nice to learn and know about God. I know that God is always with me.
St. Thomas the Apostle in Ann Arbor is having a casino-themed live and silent auction Saturday, March 5th to provide scholarships and new technological initiatives. And don't forget our open houses on the third Thursday of each month from 10 to 1. Visit sta2.org/school to learn more. That's sta2.org/school.
Some months ago, Father John Ricardo and Father Ron Brown teamed up for an evening of teaching on spiritual warfare.
I think people are here for lots of different reasons tonight. We're like mailmen. We're in the business of delivering the gospel. And because you're a mailman or a mail person, whatever you are, and you're delivering the mail, every once in a while dogs come after you to try to prohibit you from delivering the mail. So if you're a smart mailman, you carry a stick so that when the dogs come, you can beat them off and you can deliver the mail. That's what we do. But we're also trying to help people, first of all, maybe tell you better get a stick if you don't have one, and to help maybe find you a stronger one as well.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. This dynamic duo will repeat their tag team approach to teaching on November 30th. Their topic then will be the theology of the body. But on our next program, they teach on spiritual warfare. Listen to Putting on the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
I'm back with Sally Miller. Sally Miller is known, sad to say, as one of the women with whom Bill Clinton had an affair. This was over 30 years ago. Sally was single. Bill was married at the time. He was governor of Arkansas. We're talking about the things that led up to that in her life and the things that happened to her afterward. Speaking of your life prior to that incident, you won Miss Arkansas in 1958. You were a top 10 finalist in Atlantic City at the Miss America pageant. You won the talent competition, and you were invited back the following year to perform at the pageant as well. And you had a date with Ricky Nelson, but you never had a second date. Could you tell our listeners about that?
I hope that most of your listeners know who Ricky Nelson was.
I watch the Nelson TV show every week, and I must say I had a kind of a boy crush on Ricky Nelson. I loved his voice, and I learned to sing all his songs.
He had the prettiest eyes and the most interesting lips. And it's funny, on Facebook, several of my friends have said, you know, I was fascinated with his lips. He had the prettiest lips. And, of course, that was my reaction, too.
Well, he did. I mean, I know whenever they had him sing a song at the end of the show, the camera came way in on his face and caught those droopy eyes of his. And he was an extremely attractive man. There's no question about it.
What
was he a gentleman on the first date?
Oh, he was the most perfect guy I can imagine. My roommate was Anita Bryant. She had been Miss Oklahoma. And we both were invited back to the entertainers at the next pageant, the next year's pageant, when Marianne Mobley, Marianne won from Mississippi the year I was Miss America. And then she came back, of course, to give her crown to whomever won the 1959 crown. But one night, Anita and I got together, you know, the first night that we were roommates, and she said something about having tickets to the, what was it called, on the boardwalk. Anyway, it was where he was performing. And I said, why do we want to go there? And she said, because my friend Ricky is there, and he's giving us tickets. And I said, Ricky? She said, Ricky. Of course, I was beyond myself at that point.
Well, he was one of the two or three biggest pop stars of that era.
He was. He was a heartbreaker. He was.
Yeah.
Of course, we referred to him as a heartthrob in those days.
Yeah.
That really dates us, I know. He was performing at the Steel Pier, which a very famous, popular place that attracted the top singers, the top performers. And after his performance, he came down and he met me and Anita. And Anita had another friend, another guy friend. And he said, come on, let's go do something. And Ricky said, come on, you and I are going to go do something. So we went to eat, and then we strolled the boardwalk, the famous boardwalk in Atlantic City.
With Ricky Nelson, arm in arm.
Oh, yes.
Oh, wow.
And he got me back to my hotel room, got me back to my hotel, and we were standing, the restaurant had closed, we were standing kind of in a little niche that was dark, and he kissed me. And kissed me several times, as a matter of fact, before.
You didn't fall down? You didn't swoon or anything?
No, but I didn't pull away.
You were 20 years old, right?
I was 20, and Ricky was probably 18 at the time.
Lord.
I guess I've always liked younger men. It just
way. And then set up a date for the next night.
He did. Now, he was a gentleman. You see, in those days, a man would not have walked me to my hotel room. He would have stopped at the elevator. He would never have gone upstairs, and especially with anyone connected with the pageant, because we were supposed to be chaperoned every place. But having come back the next year, I didn't have a chaperone, but still, there was that respect factor.
Right.
So he kissed me at the elevator, and I, you know, zoomed up to my floor, got off, and I think I danced all the way down the hall to the room. It was exciting. And he had already said, now we're going to get together tomorrow night, you know, after the show, and if you want, you want me to pick you up here at the room, and you can come to my performance. And we made arrangements, and he gave me his number, and he said, if anything changes, give me a call, or you think about how you want us to get together tomorrow night. So I had his number, but there was a note on my door, and it announced that the guy that I was supposed to marry was coming to surprise me the next day.
Who you did not want to marry.
No, no, it was all my mother. I had a very controlling mother deal.
So this was the man, this was the man from the successful family in Pine Bluff who your mother was pushing at you.
Totally. He was 10 years older. Have you ever known some people that are young spirits at any age, and then there are people that have old spirits at any age?
I sure have.
I was born old.
I tend not to get along with the latter crowd myself.
No, I don't do well with them at all, because unless I look in the mirror, I still think I'm just this young gal that's having a great time being nice and fun.
Yeah.
And
when I'm over a golf ball, I feel like I'm 18.
When I got on that great wall, I became a 9-year-old girl that opened her geography book in the fourth grade and said, wow, it says that wall is built by hand. I must know all I can about it. And, of course, there was hardly any information.
Well, go back now. So why did you decide to go back to Pine Bluff on the train, a special train that had been arranged for you, I guess, with this man that you didn't want to marry?
Well, first of all, before I left to go back to the Miss America pageant, I assumed I could leave him in Pine Bluff, and that since I would be going to the judges' parties and I would be meeting all the pageant people, and there would be New York scouts from the Metropolitan Opera and all these other places, that someone was going to hear me sing each night, and someone was going to say, you know, Sally, we think we can arrange for you to get to New York and study.
You were called by Juilliard, by the Manhattan School of Music. Those were the best conservatories in the nation.
Yeah, I'd already had a couple of offers, you know, when I was a contestant, so they said, when you finish being Miss Arkansas, contact us. So I was pretty much banking on maybe just going back to Arkansas to pack up my bags and then move to New York. Even though my mother had made pretty clear that she was in control of my future. But, you know, when you get away from home, sometime you can dream bigger dreams than when you're in your fourth wall.
How well said.
Okay. Anyway, I was shocked, of course. Now, the railroad had furnished me with two private cars the year before, and they gave me a pass so that I could travel free. Oh,
I see.
But I prefer to travel by rail. But
well, your daddy was it? Blood was in your blood.
It was,
in Indiana.
You know, my dad. Happiest. We were all railroad people. My grandmother had been a secretary from the railroad. My brother still worked for the railroad at that time. And my father was a steam engineer. And, of course, he changed over to diesel. But railroading was in his blood.
Do you think that you just didn't have the emotional strength at the age of 20? Even after participating in the Miss America contest the previous year, to withstand your mother's demands?
Deal, I was deathly afraid of my mother. She would throw tantrums. She had a violent temper. She could make some of the ugliest faces. And when she would point her finger at me with a threat, I was scared to death. Have you ever seen a dog that has an owner who's...
Yeah, and a dog cowers and shakes.
Cowers. Tucks his tail between his legs and he cowers, gets over in the corner. I was that dog.
And there you are. I mean, this to me is so tragic. you were being offered.
This is the tragedy.
You were being offered. The doors were opening at Juilliard. Doors were possibly opening at the Metropolitan Opera, television.
I got an offer when I got home that first year of 1958 when I had competed in Miss America pageant. And within 2 weeks, I got a letter, a telegram. At those days, everything was telegrams. And it was a telegram from NBC asking me to audition for their first female hostess. They called them hostess.
On the Today Show.
On the Today Show. And
you had to give that up to marry a man that you didn't love, but that your mother frightened you into marrying.
She told me, she said, you should just be satisfied to sing for weddings and funerals in Arkansas and get rid of this childish dream that you're going to New York and do all these big things. And she said, it's not going to happen on my dime. My father was as afraid of her as I was. And when he would try to convince her, we both lost.
Well, you went on to have a miscarriage of twins, which actually was not, from your husband's point of view, a bad thing because he didn't want kids at all.
I arranged that that I was going to get pregnant because I thought, what would life be like with no children? If you're married, it's just something that makes life worthwhile. It's kind of a fulfillment. And you see, I believed in God. And I guess where I was so misled, his father's father had started this church, Central Presbyterian Church in Pine Bluff. They had beautiful stained glass windows, and they sat under the largest stained glass window that had their names, all the family
names.
Oh,
my Lord. It was like a big southern plantation, that town.
It was, and they ruled everything in that church. Nothing happened. Nothing changed hands. If they hired the organist, the produce had to approve it. So when I went there, of course, I sang for free. It wasn't a job for me, and it was to the glory of God. But I still dressed in the clothes I'd had as Miss Arkansas, and my father continued, when he would trade his car, he would give me his, quote, old car, which probably had 25 or 30,000 miles on it. But my new husband's family was a different kind of family. Now, they were there every time the church doors opened. But the first thing he said to me is, you're going to have to stop dressing like a beauty queen. And I said, but I'm just dressed like a traditional woman to come to church. No. And then you get in a nice car. Your husband has two brothers, and they have two wives. And we try to keep everything equal. I don't want you to dress better than them or drive better cars than they have.
You know, at what moment, Sally, did you realize that until we let God make our own choices, they'll always be wrong?
I probably realized before I ever married him that this is the biggest mistake that I could make in my life, but I just didn't know how to get out of it because my mother had said, as soon as you give up the crown, you better have a job, or you better have a husband, because you're not living here and you're not spending our money. And don't go to your daddy and whine about it, because I make the rules in this house.
So you ignored your better judgment in terms of what was coming to you from God, and went with the control that your mother had over you.
I never, you know, I hear God often inside me. He's here with me now. But I don't think I had matured enough to understand that what God may be telling me was really His voice, and it wasn't just me wishing that that's what I was hearing.
You doubted your own judgment, and you doubted.
My mother never let me believe I was worthy enough to have anything, and certainly not God. God was what you were sitting in the church. Anything outside of that was you.
Sally, I want to fast forward a second and remind our listeners. I'm talking to Sally Miller about a great misfortune in her life of having a brief affair with Bill Clinton over 30 years ago when he was governor, and what led up to that and what consequences were in store. Now, you stayed away from the media on this as much as you could, but in 1992, the day after the Democratic Convention had nominated Bill Clinton to run for his first term in office, you appeared on the Sally Jesse Raphael show. Now, you said to me in a phone conversation that this turned out to be a setup, that you thought it was going to be a friendlier interview. How exactly did that go?
I had television shows. I'd had interviews with guests that I invited on both radio and television. And I never would have imagined telling the person that I'd invited to be on my show one thing and then doing another. It just wasn't my nature. I was always a pleaser, probably because I had the mother that I had. But I don't mind telling you, Deal, I'm a good person. So I try to think the best of other people. I arrived just seconds after the show had begun, and I heard her announce that she was pleased to have an audience full of all the Democrats attending the Democratic National Convention there in New York. Well, I'm not a politician. I don't read much about politicians. And at that time, I was trying.
You were going into the snake pit. You thought you were going to be interviewed fairly.
I thought that the audience would be full of Joe and Mo and people that did everything but think about politics. And yet everyone there was a paid employee of the Democratic Party. So
how did the interview go?
The deck is stacked, right, when I sat down.
Did Sally Jesse Raphael try to be fair at all?
No, not at all. She asked for the audience to come to a microphone and question me. She had a gal named Rita Jenrette who had posed in Playboy and had an affair with someone in politics, and I didn't even know her. And the first thing she, of course, said to me was, join the crowd. You're just one of us. If you slept with a senator, I felt dirty. And I should have left the show. I should have walked off the stage, because what I found out later, they didn't even air the tape.
Well, it was blacked. It was blacked out, and it wasn't in the U.S. and it wasn't shown at all in the United Kingdom.
No, and that's when I really became scared to think that a political party had the power not only to have me fired, but then when I went on the show, to have my appearance blacked out. When you can black out the airways of a national show, now that is power. But is it good power? No, it's not good power. It was all negative. And
didn't Sally Jesse Raphael eventually apologize to you on air for how she treated you?
The next year, I left for China. I wanted to get away from all of it. And a friend of my daughter's sent me an email, and she said, I just watched the Sally Jesse Raphael show, and she actually, on her show, apologized to you for not believing you the year before.
That's pretty courageous of her, because
she said she believes you now.
Clinton was still riding high at that point for his term in the White House.
Honestly, I think Sally's ratings had gone so far that one of her last shows was when she apologized.
She was paying her debts.
You know, I think she probably decided to leave on a high note by apologizing.
So you actually lived in China for 10 years partly just to get away from this pounding you were taking because of your 3 month affair with Bill Clinton in 1983.
The Chinese government was nicer to me than my own government. And when they invited me to returned to China as a broadcasting specialist who would teach and train Chinese boys and girls to be on-air television personalities. As I told them, I said, I don't know anything about doing the weather. I know what it's like to be on television and to report or to interview. And they said, that's what we want. We want you to bring that expertise to us. So I did. But the one thing they asked me to do, it was actually an idea that I put in their heads, and they had to approve it. We developed the technology of, I don't know how they did it, but I just knew that I could help with them in the development stage. China has millions of blind people all over China that have lived out in the countryside with no connection to the real world. So we provided them with radios and then were able to connect all the radios, all the airways, whatever they did, so that for the first time, the blind people of China heard the news. They took lessons over the airways. They enjoyed conversations and hearing about what was happening around the world. And we even taught them to speak English.
Well, you know, you made quite a service and contribution to China at that point in their development. What brought you home after 10 years from China?
The Clintons found me. It was kind of like a message, like, wherever you go, whatever you do, we can ruin it for you. We can find you and we can ruin everything. And that's what they did. They came through China and, Hillary and Bill and Madeleine Albright, who was Secretary of State at that time, made their presence known. I got a call almost every day of where they were going to be, and it was always someplace that I would visit each week, like the Pearl Market. On Sundays, I went to the Chinese Christian Church, and they had a headpiece that they provided me with, and even though the service was in Chinese, they translated it to me in English. And they sang the songs that I knew by heart. So as they're standing there singing A Mighty Fortress Is Our God in Chinese, I'm singing it in English. It was a wonderful experience.
And you were told not to go to church that day that the Clintons were there.
Oh, I received the day before. I received a call. They said it was the Secret Service at the American Embassy in Beijing. They said, don't attend Christian church on Sunday because you will not be allowed in. President Bill Clinton and First Lady Mrs. Clinton will be speaking that day at that service. And it's by invitation only. It will be the Chinese church members and the invited guests of the party, their entourage that came with them from America.
You know, Sally, we only have 2 minutes left. This has gone so quickly. Tell us how you have survived with your dignity, without crumbling into self-recrimination and giving up on life. How have you done that?
I had to turn it over to God. You know, I've been a strong believer in God all my life. He's been able to walk me through so much of the bad. But I finally, I dropped to my knees one day and I said, look, God, I'm not doing a very good job of this, and I know you're with me, but you're going to have to step forward and take the lead. I'll follow. I may not like where you take me, but as long as you're with me, we can do it together.
So that was a moment when you kind of just surrendered yourself.
In fact, I write that, yes, often. I say, I surrender all. It's one of my favorite hymns, too.
One of mine, too. As an ex-Southern Baptist, one of mine.
Well, you know, I've sung at the Christian church, at the science, Christian scientist churches, all of them. And I said, look, it may not be in your hymn book, but I know it, and I have to sing it. Every now and then, it's the fuel I need.
We've been talking to Sally Miller, who is a survivor and who survived because she handed a very difficult situation of public disgrace over to God, and she's writing a book about her experiences, which we hope will be out sometime this year. Sally Miller, thanks so much for having the guts to come on Church and Culture and share your story.
Thank you so much, Dale. It's been enjoyable.
Sure has. And to all who are listening, if you'll stick with us after the break, we're going to talk about music, which I know Sally would be pleased to hear. Thanks again, Sally.
Absolutely. Thank you.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popcha.
Some couples do a better job of prioritizing their relationships than others, but a new study from the University of Illinois shows that all couples, even ones with a more don't-sweat-it attitude toward couple time, experience a greater risk of marital problems if they don't develop their relationship work ethic. According to the study, when people enter the workplace, they make an effort to arrive on time, be productive throughout the day, listen attentively to coworkers and supervisors, and try to get along with others. Researchers say couples should be at least as invested in their relationship work ethic, prioritizing their partner and putting the same kind of energy into active listening, planning time together, finding a workable solution for sharing household tasks, and handling personal stress so it doesn't spill over into the relationship. Our faith tells us that living our vocation as husbands and wives is the most important activity on our schedule. It seems science agrees. I'm Dr. Greg Popcheck, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
You remember the day you first laid eyes on her. They handed you the keys and you drove back home for everyone to admire. And although the memories have been made, it's time to pass the torch to someone else. Consider donating your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Even if it's not running, we'll take care of everything from pickup to your tax receipt. Just call 866-628-CARS to show you just how easy it is to donate. That's 866-628-CARS. And mention Ave Maria Radio.
You don't need a rocket scientist to tell you that music has power. For homeschool graduate Scott McIntyre, touching people's hearts is the best part about being a musician. Tune in to today's Homeschool Heartbeat to hear about Scott's journey on American Idol.
Scott, tell us about your experience competing in American Idol. How did you get on the show to begin with?
I originally auditioned with my brother and my sister in San Francisco. And we were all three turned down. We were sent home by the first producers that heard us. And fortunately, though, we went back in Phoenix, Arizona, just a couple months later, the same year, and all three of us made it through. And then I kept making it through again and again and round after round and ended up in the final round. So I was so grateful that I didn't give up after the first try.
Well, tell us, what was the best part of being on American Idol?
The best part for me was really seeing how my story and my music touched people around the world, how it inspired them.
Well, you've already recorded several albums before you were on American Idol. Did being on American Idol actually help you professionally after that?
Absolutely. I did have a career in music. I performed a lot, but I was not making a living at it. And after American Idol, it opened up so many doors that now I get to wake up every morning and do what I love and support a family and get to inspire people in the process. So I'm so grateful for the gift that American Idol was to me.
Well, Scott, thanks for inspiring us today and giving us a glimpse of your life as a professional musician. And until next time, I'm Mike Smith.
Today's program was part of a longer interview. If you'd like to hear the whole thing, you can find it on our website at homeschoolheartbeat.com. And to find other programs like the one you heard today, visit our website at homeschoolheartbeat.com.
Weekdays at noon, it's More to Life.
Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Popcheck.
And I'm Lisa Popcheck. Each weekday on